A flock of monarch butterflies gathering together for the migration south can be a truly magical sight. But it's a sight that has become less and less common in Iowa. It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbe. It's Horticulture Day, and this hour we'll find out what's happened to those beautiful flocks of monarch butterflies. Iowa State University Extension entomologist Donald Lewis will be here. We'll talk about the pressures that have resulted in the smallest population of monarchs ever recorded. Iowa State University Extension horticulturist Richard Giron will also be here, and he and Donald will answer your questions. Join our conversation after the news. It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbe. Good morning. It's Horticulture Day today, and over the past few years, we've been getting a number of calls periodically from people who've asked, why don't I see as many monarch butterflies as I used to? And the answer is because there aren't as many monarch butterflies as there used to be. Iowa State University Extension entomologist Donald Lewis is here with us today to tell us why that is. Good morning, Donald.
Hello, Charity. Good to be here.
Well, thank you so much for being here. And when I was growing up, I remember every once in a while I would stumble across a big flock of monarchs in the fall. And we even had a tree stump on our property where sometimes all the monarchs would get together and gather. And that was fairly common in Iowa.
Used to be quite common. And Richard and I were talking before we went on the air about driving in the fall of the year. You would cringe as you struck monarchs with the windshield or the grill of your car, because every minute or so, especially in this period of sort of late September, there would be a monarch crossing the road in front of you, and you would see just monarchs all the time during the southern migration as they move from Canada down through Iowa on their way to central Mexico, where they overwinter. Overnight, they would stop, and every once in a while, you would get to see a tree that was covered with tens of thousands of monarchs. And it has changed, and those days are gone.
When did it start changing?
Well, it came up on us slowly, but the peak monarch abundance as measured down in Mexico happened about 16 years ago. That would put it back 1996, 1997. And we have been on a gradual decline ever since then. But the decline really accelerated in the early 2000s, that the number of monarchs as measured in Mexico at their overwintering site was dropping dramatically, and the number of observations of monarchs in the north was dropping dramatically. And of course, it's a circle. We produce monarchs up here in the upper Midwest. In fact, we produce about half of the monarchs for the country are produced here in the upper Midwest. Those monarchs move to Mexico in the fall of the year. They overwinter. They start back. They migrate northward in the spring. And when we send fewer and fewer of them survive, we get fewer the next year. And it's been a downward spiral every year.
And now the population is at its smallest ever recorded?
The smallest ever. The population, as it was recorded in down in Mexico this past winter, the before this year, was 1/20th of what it was back in over the winter of 1996 and 1997. That's measured by the area that the monarch butterflies take in their overwintering sites on the hillside forests of central Mexico. But 1/20th the population that we had at its peak.
That is a dramatic and really rapid decline.
It is, and it's because of several reasons. There's not one reason that we can point to, but one of the biggest changes that coincides with this change in monarch populations is the adaptation of Roundup-ready corn and soybeans in the crop-producing areas of the upper Midwest. Unfortunately, we had some research going on about milkweed populations in cropland. Milkweed is the food source of the monarch caterpillars. You must have milkweeds in order to support the monarch caterpillars. And in the cropland fields of Iowa, the milkweed population declined 81% since 1999. So the introduction of Roundup Ready corn and soybeans meant a broad-spectrum herbicide was being applied, and milkweeds were essentially eliminated from cropland and the areas surrounding it. So that decline in milkweed populations because of a change in farming practices is one of the big factors.
What are some of the other factors?
Well, we can always point to urban sprawl. We have about 2 million acres of natural or farmland area taken out of production every year to urban sprawl and to street building and so forth. So there's less prairie out there. There's less cropland every year because of that. The other thing that we can look at, and we can talk about ethanol production as a possible contributing factor, because we are now producing 25 million new acres of crop ground since 2006. So at the same time we were increasing our use of a broad-spectrum herbicide, we were growing corn and soybeans on more acres, and that coincides with a decrease in the CRP field. When you think about where are the milkweeds, they are in pastures and roadsides and CRP fields and crop ground, because the common milkweed does well in those disturbed soil sites. So loss of field margins because we're planting fence row to fence row, as Earl Butts used to say, and we've taken out the fence rows. But those new crop acres in response to the high crop prices have also had their effect. And then finally, global warming is in this picture. Global climate change is influencing the monarch butterflies in adverse ways. One of the problems is warmer temperatures in Mexico are decreasing the forest available for monarch butterflies, along with logging, which appears to have been pretty much stopped in that part of Mexico. But logging was reducing the forest, and then climate change is going to reduce that forest. Warmer spring temperatures mean the monarchs leave hibernation sooner. They get to the upper Midwest where it's still cold. They don't reproduce as well. We've had droughts now for several years, or dry weather, which influences and impacts their food source, reduces the availability of food, impacts the ability of the females to lay eggs, reduces the ability of the caterpillars to survive. Hot, dry summers have been a detriment to butterflies. All of this just swirls around, and the population keeps declining and spiraling downward. The monarch butterfly is circling the drain.
Well, I was just going to ask that question. Is this considered to be an endangered species, or on the path to becoming an endangered species?
It worries a lot of people. We're not at the point of endangerment yet. It's not a threatened species. But as these declines happen, we're at a point where people are talking about the decline. People are noticing the decline. If the monarch population falls much lower, people will stop paying attention. And when that happens, we certainly could be in a threatened or endangered species. I don't think the monarchs are going to go away, and I'm one of the two or three most optimistic people I've ever met. So I don't think this is the end of the world as we know it. It's not the end of the monarch butterfly, but this situation brings me as close to crying or cursing as anything has lately, that the change that has taken place just in the last decade and a half is so dramatic and so detrimental to the butterflies.
Butterflies are so beautiful, and we love butterflies, and people are sad because they're not seeing the monarch butterfly as much. But why does it matter if we have monarch butterflies, in your opinion?
We ask this question every time there's a snail darter issue that holds up a building of a dam, or spotted owls. The loss of a species by itself may not have an impact. We may go on living. We may be just as happy without butterflies. We'll adjust somehow. But it's a bit of the canary in the coal mine, that if we're losing an obvious species like monarch butterflies, what else is going on that we're not thinking about? So biodiversity is one of the things we really appreciate and enjoy. We know we need pollinators. We know we need this diversity that's around us for a healthy ecosystem. And if we're losing this one, the question is, what else are we losing?
What can be done right now? I'm sure there are a lot of people listening who think, I would plant milkweed if that's going to make a difference. Does that make a difference?
It's been talked about and it's being tried. A website that your listeners should check out is monarchwatch.org. And they actually ran a program trying to sell milkweeds to people to plant them. But we're talking about 100 million acres of crop ground that have changed their practices for the benefit of the livelihood of the people who are owning and farming that land. And the hope that those of us living in urban environments could somehow replace the milkweeds that used to grow on 125 million acres is probably not realistic. But certainly allowing milkweeds to prosper and to live in fence rows and farm margins and the areas where we can allow them would certainly be part of it. And we have always encouraged people to grow milkweed as part of their butterfly gardening. Maybe stepping that up would help. I can't believe it would really overcome the deficit of the milkweeds that we have out in the countryside.
With the, of course, large acres that are committed to cropland, is there a problem if there are these patches of milkweed that are not connected by any other food sources for the monarchs? Or do little patches make a difference since the monarchs can fly?
Ecologists are always talking about environmental fragmentation, and it certainly has a tremendous impact on species where it has been measured. I don't know the answer specifically for monarchs. They do seem to move about quite well. Females scatter their eggs. It's unusual to find a milkweed that has lots and lots of monarch eggs on it. She lays them one at a time, and she'll find a milkweed and lay one egg here, fly for a while, lay another egg somewhere else. So my guess is fragmented patches would help and may not be as bad a thing as ecologists find with some other species that have to migrate from patch to patch. The monarch can certainly fly from area to area.
With the dramatic decline that we've seen over a very brief period, I'm sure that entomologists are projecting into the future. How much time do we have to make a change?
I don't know that anyone has sat down and tried to think of that exactly. They're still documenting how much change has occurred. We're documenting some of the causes for it. We've mentioned milkweed decline. I don't think milkweeds are going to come back anytime soon. Climate change is a factor. I don't expect that to reverse very quickly. So I think we may bottom out, as we say. I don't think we're going to bottom out as zero, but the population will be much lower. And I agree with some of the other specialists who spend full time thinking about the monarch that those swarms you saw while you were driving in September, those monarch trees that you saw in your backyard, will not see those again.
Iowa State University Extension entomologist Donald Lewis. It's Horticulture Day today on Talk of Iowa. We've been talking about the monarch butterfly. Iowa State University Extension horticulturist Richard Giron will join us in just a moment, and he and Donald will answer your questions about plants and insects. 866-780-9100 is the number to call. This is Talk of Iowa. It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbe. It's Horticulture Day today, and you are welcome to join our conversation with your questions about plants or insects. The number to call is 866-780-9100, 866-780-9100. You can also send email to talkofiowa@iowapublicradio.org. You can tweet us at IPR Talk, or you can post on our Facebook page. And we've also put a link up on our Facebook page to monarchwatch.org if you'd like more information about the declining monarch butterfly population. With me, Iowa State University Extension entomologist Donald Lewis and ISU Extension horticulturist Richard Giron. Good morning, Richard.
Good morning.
Thank you so much for being here today, Richard.
You're welcome.
And we will get to the phones in just a second. One more butterfly question. This is from Jake in Olwine, and we've talked a lot about the butterfly populations. We haven't talked a lot about their life cycle, but he wants to know if it's the same butterflies that come back from Mexico or if it's a different generation.
It's one or two generations removed. The monarchs that we send to Mexico in the fall of the year hibernate and come back as far as Texas, as far as maybe New Mexico, and they reproduce. Their offspring continue the trek northward, And so it's the grandchildren or great-grandchildren of the monarchs that we sent to Mexico that we get back. They reproduce on the way back north, and we don't get that first flush that came out of Mexico. Once they get here, we have two generations of monarchs, at least sometimes three. Some people claim four, but okay, two to four generations of monarchs reproduce here in the upper Midwest. So we're sending back to Mexico what is now maybe the great-great-great-great-grandchildren of the original ones that we sent. So there are lots of generations between migrations.
And what are milkweed populations like in New Mexico and Texas?
Suffering because of drought. Drought has been extensive in New Mexico, Texas area. Temperatures have been warmer, so the monarchs maybe fly a little farther than they used to. It's tough all around for the monarchs. They have trouble surviving in Mexico. They have trouble reproducing in Texas. They have trouble reproducing in the upper Midwest, and they're just spiraling downward.
All right. Let's go to the phones. Marty is on the line in Garner. Hi, Marty.
Hi, good morning.
Hi, what's your question?
Two quick ones. I found a tagged monarch the other day and reported it, and apparently it was the University of Kansas is doing a study, but I don't know any of the results of that. I just thought I'd mention that. Mm-hmm. Also, the monarchs that I've seen are smaller, mm-hmm. and obviously I haven't seen as many as you. The grasshoppers have been out here, but not too many monarchs, so I'll hang up. Thank you.
All right. Thanks a lot for your call, Marty.
The tagging program has been a tremendous success. The tagging program began back in the 70s, and that's how the migratory routes of the monarch butterfly were determined. That entomologist up in Canada started it all, and he was putting these little paper tags with these little tiny serial numbers on the edge of the wing of the monarch butterfly and letting them go. And there was a phone number or an address, and people would call and say, "Hey, I found one of your tagged monarchs." And he tracked those reports back to the mountains of central Mexico. That tagging program continues, and Monarch Watch, the group we've mentioned and the link that's on your website, is the leading in doing that. And school children for decades now have tagged monarchs in the fall of the year. But with fewer and fewer monarchs present, it's getting harder and harder to get schools interested in tagging when the kids get all excited and then they go out and can't find one.
Right.
The conditions that decrease monarchs may actually increase grasshoppers. The hot, dry weather we've had was very good for grasshopper reproduction. So it just shows that not everything responds to the conditions in the same way.
But there's not as much call for tagging of grasshoppers.
Yeah, they're not nearly as exciting.
I don't know. My son's been pretty excited about catching them lately. But Bill is on the line in West Des Moines. And Bill, you've been involved in tagging butterflies?
Yes, I've been doing this since 94, and I've seen this terrible decline, and I used to get like 125 tags. Now I'm down to 50, and I've had two recoveries way back 8 years ago that they found in Mexico.
Wow.
But the other day, I just finished up my 50 tags, and the only place I could find them on was the purple flower, which they like, is alfalfa. I found an alfalfa field in bloom, so... Anyway, that's kind of cool. I've had two recoveries, and there's a couple of years. I only got one here 2 years ago because of this drought and whatever all. But So if I get two more quick questions in, ask Richard about what I see on these oak trees that are red oaks, and some of them they got these dead blotches all over the trees. And
Answer that one, and then we'll move on.
How big are these blotches? Are they just small little limbs?
It's the new growth out on the ends.
Okay. That's something that we see pretty commonly in mid to late summer. And no one knows exactly what's involved there. Some people think it might be due to a twig borer, possibly.
There are insects that bore in the twigs, but when we go out here on campus and look at the clusters of dead leaves at the terminal of the twig, we cut those off, we slice those stems open, we don't find that borer. There are other people who think it's a fungus.
Right. So there is those two thoughts, but no one has determined the exact cause. But it's something fairly common, and it doesn't seem to kill the trees, so we kind of ignore it, but It's fairly common on trees on campus here at Iowa State, in the Ames area. So it's fairly common. We're aware of it. We're just not sure of the cause. But it tends to be something that's fairly inconsequential.
Yeah, okay. I've noticed quite a bit of it this year, so
yeah.
Okay. All right, thank you.
All right, did you have your second question, Bill?
Well, I had one. If you were 20 or 30 years old, what kind of trees would you plant in Iowa now with the way things are going?
What would I plant? I would look at diversity. I like oaks. I'm real fond of the bur oak and the red oak. I like maples, like the sugar maple and the black maple. I like lindens. They're a nice tree. And then you have to have some ornamentals like crab apples and things like that.
All right. Let's go next to Phyllis on the line in Washington. Hi, Phyllis.
Hi.
Hi, what's your question?
Well, we have a couple of apple trees, and of course, during the course of the year, a lot of them will drop, you know, with maybe they'll have worms or spots and so forth. And my husband said, well, let's put those on the compost pile. But years ago, his dad had lots of apple trees, and his dad said, don't ever put those on the compost pile because you're just putting a place for the worms to grow and the disease to perpetuate. So should I put, like, drop apples that have worms and so forth in the compost pile, or should I get rid of them somewhere else?
Well, the question is, do you have a compost pile that heats up to 140 to 180 degrees? Does the material break down completely? Or do you just have what I have, a pile of plant debris that never quite really breaks down?
Yeah, I would say that we do not have the heat to break it down.
So there is the possibility that caterpillars that you that are in the apples are going to survive in that brush pile and turn into moths next year and move back to your apple tree. But if you were fastidious and got rid of every dropped apple, every blemished fruit, if you buried it 8 feet deep at the bottom of a post hole, you would still have insects the following year because they are in all of the hosts around you. Other people have apple trees that they're not taking care of. They could be in crab apples. They can be in other species in the woodlands around you. So while theoretically it sounds good to do what I can to reduce sources of infestations for the following year, mm-hmm. in practice, it probably doesn't make any difference, and I would do what's easiest, I guess. What do you think, Richard?
Put them in the compost pile.
Go ahead and put them in the compost
pile.
Yeah.
Because it won't make much difference. Yeah.
It won't make much difference. And if you had a lot of bad ones, if you had a lot of codling moth damage, you see the little eruptions of sawdust at the end of the apples, you might say, okay, I'm going to do what I can and discard these by burying them rather than just putting them in the brush pile. But it's not going to hurt. It's not going to make much difference. And I can tell you another experience, another person I know who raises a few hobby apple trees, and this is the cleanest, most fastidious guy I know. No dropped apples last more than about 45 seconds under his tree. He still has apple maggot damage. So sanitation alone won't stop all your problems.
Okay, that sounds good.
All right, Phyllis, thanks
a
lot
for
your call.
Bye.
Bye. Next up, let's go to Lori in Ames. Hi, Lori.
Well, hi. I'm from Ames area. I live in a trailer court, and we've gotten a bunch of new trailers in, so it's filling up quickly. And we have a trouble with wasps. There are wasps in the mailboxes. There's wasps in the siding of the houses.
Mm-hmm.
And I try to get rid of mine, but it doesn't seem to matter because they go away, they fly away, and they fly back. And then I'm just worried about, like, is there a time of year that they get more aggressive or fly together or whatever?
depends.
I'm worried.
Depends on the species. If we're talking about the mud daubers that make the mud tubes, they never do get aggressive. But if we're talking about paper wasps that make the little upside-down umbrella-shaped nest, or if we're talking about hornets in the trees or yellow jackets in the ground, yes, in the fall of the year, they do get a little easier to aggravate, and they can be aggressive. Wasp populations appear to be down this year. We don't have as many, it appears to me, and they seem to be a little later in arriving. But for wasp control, the only thing we have is to treat the nests as they appear. We don't have any repellents for wasps. We have these ideal nesting sites up under the eaves, under your porch, in your mailbox. These are protected locations that the wasps are going to find. We don't have anything we can put there before the wasps arrive that will make a difference. So we watch for wasp nests to start. When they do, we use either an aerosol spray or a soapy water spray to kill the wasps as they begin their nests, and we just keep watching and keep killing the nests and hope that they will move off to a less trafficked area and build out of sight, out of mind. But as far as prevention, there's nothing we can do until they arrive.
Yeah. They kind of have a bunch of them around a nest. They seem to be like in the walls, kind of the siding of the trailers. I don't know how they got in there, but they seem to have made their nest inside of there.
Mm-hmm. It takes the smallest of openings for these insects who have nothing to do all day long but look for a place to nest. They've got no other job. They don't have to go to work. All they do all day long is look for these cracks and openings, these protected and sheltered locations. Yellow jackets are about the only one that will actually nest inside the wall. Often the paper wasps, the ones that make the upside-down umbrellas, they will be sort of behind and under siding, but not necessarily in the wall cavity itself. But direct nest treatment with usually soapy water or aerosol sprays or a dust insecticide in the case of hornets or wasps in the ground remain our control options.
All right, Lori, thanks a lot for your call. It's Horticulture Day on Talk of Iowa. You're welcome to join our conversation at 866-780-9100. And back to the milkweed conversation. John is on the line from rural Knoxville. Hello, John.
Hello.
Hi, what's your question?
Well, we have a small patch of milkweed in our yard and about 15 plants, and it's always supported a monarch population. The last few years, though, there's a progressive yellowing from the top down in the majority of the plants, and they don't reach maturity. And I just wondered what that might be and if it's just a local issue or if it's more widespread.
I am not sure on that. Are the plants actually dying, or?
There's most of them die. Some of them lose the top half and then seem to survive. Mm-hmm. It's adjacent to a daylily patch that seems to also have some kind of more premature mortality to it also.
Yeah.
So I don't know if that's a coincidence or.
I think it is.
But it's disappointing because they've always supported a small monarch population.
Right. I doubt that the daylilies and milkweeds are sharing much other than the weather. And
yep.
Dr. John Pleasance in the what we call in the botany department here at Iowa State University has studied milkweeds extensively and has commented about the early senescence of the milkweeds the last few years, that they just dry out, they mature faster, probably because of the weather. And the downside of that is it further stresses the monarchs because they won't lay eggs on these old, overmature milkweed plants. Of course, they want their caterpillars to eat fresh, succulent, juicy leaves. And so the female monarch will look for younger milkweeds. And these ones that are aging out prematurely are less desirable for egg laying. So it further exasperates them. But I don't think you're alone in noticing that this early senescence of milkweeds is happening, and it's probably more weather-related. Anything else, Richard?
I'm not aware of any disease problem on those, so
no.
Probably the weather.
Mm-hmm.
All right, John, thanks a lot for your call. And we have an email that has a question about the different kinds of milkweed. There's common milkweed. There's butterfly weed. Do you need more than one kind of milkweed for monarch butterflies?
They're all good. Every what's the genus? Is it Asclepias?
Yes.
Asclepias.
Asclepias. Okay,
right.
So I was leaving out a syllable there, Asclepias. They all work. They're all butterfly hosts. It's the common milkweed, though, that is really the workhorse in producing monarch butterflies for us. Now, that one's not very attractive in your yard, and so you may choose to plant the native prairie plant butterfly milkweed instead. The monarchs will use that if they find it just as well.
All right. Here's an email from Daryl. I have a fragrant currant with yellow flowers outside my bedroom window. Due to roofing projects, et cetera, it's gotten a bit overgrown. Can I cut it back now, or do I wait until spring after it blooms?
I probably prefer to prune it in late winter. If it's really kind of misshapen or damaged, and yes, it won't bloom that year, but it should grow back, and hopefully the following year it would bloom.
All right, and here's another one we can slip in before the break from Jeff. Is it a good time of year to fertilize the strawberry bed, and how important is it to thin out the plants?
Well, you have different types of strawberries. You have June bearers, you have ever bearers, but typically we would not be fertilizing them now. If they're June bearing, we would typically fertilize them after they're done bearing, typically in late June, early July. The everbearers, typically, we would fertilize in early spring.
Okay, and do you thin out the plants?
If they are basically June bearing, we typically go out after they're done blooming and renovate the bed. And so that requires tilling, mowing off the foliage, that type of thing. But it's typically done then, not at this time of year.
All right. We're going to take a short break. We'll be back in just a moment with more of your questions at 866-780-9100. Send email to talkofiowa@iowapublicradio.org. With me today, ISU Extension entomologist Donald Lewis and ISU Extension horticulturist Richard Geron. It's Horticulture Day on Talk of Iowa. It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbe. It's Horticulture Day today, and with me, ISU Extension entomologist Donald Lewis and ISU Extension horticulturist Richard Geron, here to take your questions at 866-780-9100. Or, of course, you can send an email to talkofiowa@iowapublicradio.org. Don is on the line next from Iowa City. Hi, Don.
Hi.
Hi, what's your question?
I had a couple quick questions about some black walnut trees in my backyard. I have about seven of them. There's four that are in kind of a circle. They're probably about 70 feet high. And one of them has been dropping branches from the very top. It's dropped about three. And they're fairly big, like the biggest was probably 6 inches around.
Okay.
We did have somebody come in about 2 years ago and trim everything off. Then we thought, well, maybe it's just stress from the drought, so we've been watering it. But it dropped one, another one, fairly large one last night. So I wonder if it's that tree. Should I have somebody come in and look at it? Could it be diseased? Or?
Well, were those dead branches or live branches?
Live.
Okay. Typically, they don't drop branches unless they are physically weak or structurally weak. So I would examine the ends of that branch and see if you notice any rotting. I would suspect you would. Whenever you have some rotting, you have a weak point in that branch. And then if you have a storm or strong winds, that point may break off because it is weak. So typically they just don't drop branches unless they're structurally unsound.
Okay. I didn't notice that on the other two that dropped.
Yeah, examine the base where that branch broke off. I think you'll probably find some rotting at that point.
Okay. And then the last question is, someone told me that you could prevent the trees from producing the fruit. Is that true, and is it healthy for the tree?
Well, I don't think it's practical, no. That's what the trees are going to do, just like oaks produce acorns. There's really no good way to prevent that besides cutting the tree down, really. Mm-hmm. So you basically deal with it when they do produce a crop.
All right, Don, thank you so much for your call. And next up, let's go to Bill in Sac City. Hi, Bill.
Well, hi, Charity, and thank you for taking my call, and to Don and Richard as well. And thank you for your concern about monarch butterflies. I have a number of USDA Conservation Reserve Program, which is the CRP. I have a number of contracts that cover about 400 acres, and there are seed mixes that are recommended by the USDA, which are available through different seed suppliers. And I have yet to see one that has milkweed seed in the mix. I always add in three different milkweed species, which I hand harvest. My suggestion is that the milkweed seed should be recommended to our USDA agencies That is the Farm Service Agency and the Natural Resource Conservation Service, and also the private organization Pheasants Forever, that they come up with seed mixes that include the milkweed seeds so that we can start getting that back into our pastures and CRP areas.
Great point, Bill. And Richard and I were just talking about this, that the roadside program where they establish various wildflowers and various plantings, we don't know that milkweed is included in that either. And there would be another place that, that we could do that. Well, reestablishing and conserving milkweed has to become a much bigger priority than it has been right now to overcome the loss of milkweeds in crop fields. And the CRP fields would be a great place to do it. And I think you've hit on everybody who needs to be involved, the NRCS with their seed mixes and their reestablished with their CRP programs and so forth. So I'm 100% in agreement with you, Bill. Let's get the message out that everybody needs to have some milkweed.
And how are you going to do that?
Oh, let's see. I think I'll mention it on WOI Radio. Right. How's that?
That's a good start. It's a good start. As it develops, you let us know.
All right.
Let's go to Suzanne on the line in Grinnell. Hi, Suzanne.
Hi. Actually, it dovetails exactly with what you were just saying. That another thing is that you mentioned the economic incentives for farming in the way that we're farming, and the Farm Bill is under consideration right now, and what different programs get omitted or furthered makes a big difference in what we're going to see and what gets planted, and particularly the CRP going out of CRP and into crop ground. If there were some suggestions of trying to get a program, and I don't know whether it went through, but a program to incentivize having CRP go to grazing and managed grazing, and that that might help the production or rehabilitation of this milkweed. So I just want to urge people to think about that and maybe contact the legislator that this is important and that what we support financially with the government programs will affect our monarch population.
Certainly does. And an example of that, the Farm Bill in the past has provided funding to establish plantings that favor pollinators and natural enemies. And that's one that we hope continues in the Farm Bill as well to encourage this biodiversity. So I agree with you, Suzanne. I hope the legislators are listening and will help us make milkweeds and pollinators and the other things that we're going to miss when they're gone a national priority.
You can join our conversation at 866-780-9100. You can tweet us at IBR Talk. You can also send email to talkofiowa@iowapublicradio.org. Let's answer a couple more email questions. This one's from Joe in Beaverdale. I have several varieties of crabapple trees, and I wonder if it's necessary to trim them so there is a central leader, or do I leave them so they resemble a regular apple tree?
Well, they're not a shade tree, so they don't really have that central leader typically, or it's not as pronounced. You do want to have a single trunk as it comes up, but then it's going to branch out in various branches. So it's not nearly as critical as it would be for a shade tree.
And he has one more question. He's wondering, and I hope I say this right, when it's safe to prune a Weigela plant?
Okay, they bloom typically in late May, early June. They bloom on the previous year's growth. They also bloom on new growth later on in the summer. So as far as pruning them, you may have some dead wood in them. And if you do, you'd prune that out in early spring. Otherwise, you would prune them out after that big flush of bloom in late May, early June.
All right. And Tim has a question. He says, I have a well-established clump of prairie grass. I think it's big blue stem. I would like to divide it and move it. Is it okay to move in the fall or should I wait until spring?
I would definitely do it in the spring. Basically, you want to do that when you start to see some signs of life near the ground. At that point, you can dig it up, divide it, maybe with an axe or whatever, if it's a big clump. But definitely early in the spring would be best.
All right, let's go back to the phones. And we do still have time for a couple more calls at 866-780-9100. Andy is on the line in Boone. Hi, Andy.
Hello, good morning to you.
Hi, what's your question about?
We're gonna dig into this one. About 2 weeks ago, I was out in my back patio and have a big combination pot with herbs in it. And my parsley, started to look at that because it wasn't looking real good. And it was absolutely loaded with dozens and dozens of monarch butterfly caterpillars. So I thought that was probably one of the neatest things I've ever seen. My question now is, how do I allow them to overwinter? How do I get them to overwinter to be able to hopefully build my little population up?
I'm going to suggest that what the caterpillars that you had on parsley are the immature stage of the black swallowtail. It's a swallowtail butterfly that uses parsley and dill as a food source for her caterpillars. So look up black swallowtail, do a Google search of black swallowtail caterpillar image, and see if that doesn't match what was on your plant. If that's the case, they will make their chrysalis hanging on the stems of that plant. And the chrysalis is a little bullet-shaped case. It has its point downward. They are sort of strapped to the stem with a little piece of silk. And what you do to preserve them is don't clean up your garden in the fall of the year. You leave the dead fennel, the dead parsley, the dead dill. You leave that, those stems and that dead foliage, you leave it there all winter because that's where the chrysalis is spending the winter. This is not a butterfly that leaves the state to make it through the winter. They will hibernate here in the state and resume next year.
All right, Andy, thanks a lot for your call. Next, let's go to Patty in Toddville. Hi, Patty.
Hi, Patty. Hi. Hey, y'all. Thanks for the talk on the monarchs. That was really cool. I do have some peachy hydrangea bushes, mm-hmm. And they're beautiful, and they're huge. They've like gone into tree form almost. I'm guessing they're about 5 feet tall over.
Okay.
But they've gotten to where, you know, of course, when they get big, they weigh each other down, you know, and then they, of course, when they're done doing what they do, they start to look a little ragged. But when should I cut those back, and how far should I cut them back?
Well, we normally don't really prune them a great deal. We typically don't. If you were to prune them, I would do so immediately after blooming in the spring.
Okay. Well, see, mine don't bloom until August. These are PG hydrangeas.
Okay.
They don't, I mean, they don't even come out until August.
Oh, excuse me. Okay.
This is the tree, the bush
okay.
tree, not the just
right,
plant.
Right. I was thinking of something different. Sorry. As far as pruning them, I would prune them basically in late March, early April, before
okay.
they leaf out.
Right.
And you can prune them back as much as you want.
Okay.
They do bloom on new growth, so they should grow back, and they should bloom later on that summer.
Yeah, it seems like every time I cut them back, they just keep getting bigger and bigger. It's
right.
amazing.
Right. It's a fairly large shrub. But it does bloom on new wood, so you can prune them back fairly severely if you want in early spring, late winter.
Thank you so much, guys. And, hey, do the monarchs like the butterfly houses? Because I have a couple, and I just don't have the milkweed, but I guess I'll get some milkweed.
Butterfly houses are a nice advertisement that you are sympathetic and empathetic with butterflies. There are almost no butterflies. We're down to just a couple that will hibernate here in Iowa through the winter in the adult stage. And that's what your butterfly house is supposed to attract, is the one or two species, including the mourning cloak butterfly, that spend the winter as an adult. Monarchs don't spend the winter here. They go south. The black swallowtail that the previous caller was talking about, they spend the winter as the pupa. So there aren't a lot of butterflies that will spend the winter as an adult, but it's a nice sign. It's a nice advertisement that you care. So
well,
leave it up.
Well, and they're really cute, too. A lot of them are.
Well, yeah, they can be quite decorative. And it's like putting a sign in your garden that says butterflies welcome. And if they show up, it's a good thing. And we hope they do.
All right. Next up, Dale in Linn County. Hi, Dale.
Hey, how you doing?
Hi. What's your question?
My question is about thornless blackberries. I've got a nice large patch that has it was planted 3 years ago. Never really got up to speed on how to take care of them, and it has turned into a 5-foot to 8-foot tall mass of produces some huge, beautiful berries. And we want to kind of get it in order and know what's supposed to be done on a yearly basis. Just wondering about the pruning and the thinning, you know, when and what to take out and so on and so forth.
Yeah, I think on those I would go out early next spring and with some twine and maybe a yardstick or whatever, and I would mark off a 2-foot wide bed, and I would retain the plants in that bed, and I would probably destroy the plants beyond that, because once they become a thicket, they're very hard to manage as far as pruning and pulling weeds and harvesting fruit. So I would try to maintain those like in a 2-foot wide row. And when the canes get maybe around, well, let's say 3.5 feet tall, I would remove the growing point, just pinch it off by hand or use a pruning shears and remove that upper inch or two. And that way the canes will stop growing as far as in length. So they won't get to be maybe 6-8 feet tall and then kind of flop on over to the ground. So I would do that as they grow in the summer.
All right, Dale, thanks a lot for your call. Tracy's up next in Ankeny. Quickly, Tracy.
Hi. I have a question about Creeping Charlie. I've had the problem at each house I've owned, but it's at the worst where I am now. Our backyard is apparently a former swamp and tends to get that way again every time we get a hard rain. So I have Creeping Charlie over at least 2/3 and no grass whatsoever. And I would love to kill off the Creeping Charlie and try to get some lawn back there. Any ideas?
Well, yeah, you basically have to destroy what's there.
Okay.
And I think you basically have two ways of doing it. You can use something like Roundup,
mm-hmm.
Where you destroy everything. That's a herbicide.
Okay.
The other thing is you can simply go out with a hoe and physically cultivate it and destroy it. But
okay.
Basically, you have to destroy it completely. There's really
okay.
nothing to save.
Would it be good to do that in the fall and try to seed then, or should I destroy it in the fall and plant in the spring? What's the timing on it?
I would destroy it this fall, sometime in the next month or two. Basically have it totally destroyed by, let's say, the end of October. And then I would sow my grass seed next spring early and make sure that you choose a shady lawn mix. That typically contains things like creeping red fescue, hard fescue, chewings fescue, but the fine leaf fescues, basically. They're very shade tolerant.
All right. Richard Giron, thank you so much today.
You're welcome.
Iowa State University Extension horticulturist Richard Giron and Donald Lewis, thank you.
Thank you, Charity.
ISU Extension entomologist Donald Lewis. We will be back with Horticulture Day next Friday, although it will be a little bit different format next Friday. With me now is Ben Kiefer. He's the host of River to River. He'll tell us what's coming up on River to River today at noon, and then we'll talk about next Friday.
Yes, very quickly. It's our news buzz for this Friday coming up at noon. We'll talk about the power outages in the Des Moines area, also the outlook as far as the drought goes with our recent rains, some improvement there. And finally, we'll talk with Dubuque native, we'll hear about Dubuque native Brooks Whelan. He's one of the new cast members to Saturday Night Live. We'll talk with a former cast member about what he's to expect, but we have Iowa Week next
That's
week,
right.
don't we,
All Chair? Next week on Talk of Iowa and River to River, it's Iowa Week. We're going to be talking about innovative, inspirational, remarkable Iowans all week long. And next Friday, of course, we'll be talking about horticulturists.
Yes, it'll be an exciting week. You'll not want to miss it. Thanks, Charity.
Thank you very much, Ben. River to River again coming up today at noon. Talk of Iowa is produced by Dennis Reese, Emily Woodbury, Sarah Bowden, and Ben Stanton. Executive producer Catherine Perkins with technical support from Jason Burns.